Welcome back to session 33. Today's session is called Support Dynamics and Recovery. It was Linda Child who said, "The cure for all ills and wrongs, the cares, the sorrows, and the crimes of humanity, all lie in one word, love. It is a divine vitality that everywhere produces and restores life." With that in mind, we're going to look at something very close to home. The need to identify the right kind of support so that recovery is the natural outcome. This may seem like a bit of a no-brainer. When you're unable to do what you can usually do, then it would follow that any kind of support is helpful. However, there are no real guidelines, are there? You and your family or supporters are probably just muddling through the best you can. We know that is what so many of us did in recovery. It's only with the benefit of hindsight that we realise that having some guidelines of what constitutes good support makes things a little bit easier for all concerned. So today, come straight from the horse's mouth, from carers themselves to get their perspective to learn what it feels like from the carer's point of view and what they feel would have been useful to know. From here on in, we will call them supporters because a support is there until you no longer need it. Whereas the word carer has so many long-term connotations. So, how much support is enough? When is it too much? What do all concerned need to guard against? What can a recoverer do to ensure their supporter has what they need? This session is most effective when you, as a recoverer, share the information with the people who are helping you. This can democratically implement any changes that you need for your own recovery. The last thing we want to do is upset those amazing angels we have in our lives that care for us and are rooting for us to get better. However, it's vital to ensure that unhealthy dynamics don't get set up. Our first supporter story comes from a mum whose daughter became bedbound with a diagnosis of ME. She says, "The worst thing was when my daughter was in bed for 6 weeks. At 17 years old, that's really not a good place to be. She was so weak, I had to carry her to the bathroom. I was working at the time and soon realised I couldn't be a part-time mum when she was so ill, so I had to stop work to look after her. ME, or CFS, wasn't recognised back then as much as it is now. I remember feeling totally alone and had nobody to talk to about this or help us. The doctors didn't understand it, and as the days, weeks and months went by, the worse my daughter became. Just seeing her lying there day after day was heartbreaking for me and my husband. All I wanted to do was take it away. I would have taken her place if I could have, so she could be a healthy teenager. I remember the long nights of crying myself to sleep as I felt totally useless. The other thing that was really hard was that none of her friends supported her. They just didn't understand. She looked okay when she did have a little energy to see them. So I became her best friend as well as her mum. If you do have special friends that are supporting you through this, then cherish them, as you are very lucky to have them. And it really shows you who your good friends are when you're going through something like this." Eventually, my daughter regained her strength. But I still felt useless most of the time, and that feeling never went away. Our whole lives revolved around her illness, and that carried on for years. What I did to help was love, care, and be there for her, always asking how she was feeling and doing what I could to help. I always felt there was something I should have done to protect her from this. Now I realise that part of my caring so much actually played a role in keeping her stuck in her condition for longer. When she was feeling better, I was always worried she would do too much. Of course now, I understand there's a fine balance between not doing too much and holding yourself back. But I was always worried, so that I kept saying, "Be careful, don't push yourself." I asked every day, many times a day, "How are you feeling?" Even though we knew that she wasn't feeling good, we would keep talking about it, which didn't help her or us. The shift that made the difference. Once we finally realised this and started changing the language we used, and when we spent time together, we focused on having fun and laughing not talking about it all the time. Slowly, it made a difference. It took a while to make these changes because we had developed the habit of saying the same things every day. But eventually we did stop, and I also stopped worrying too much and stopped feeling guilty because I accepted that it wasn't anything I had done or not done. A new kind of support. Being there, loving, supporting and caring had played its role, but I realised I needed to support her in a different way, to be a positive support. I reminded her sometimes to change the subject when she talked about her symptoms, and we called her bad days, PJ days, pajama day. I was just there to help her laugh and not worry that it was forever. It's just one PJ day. One thing I did do was to ensure that Kelly built up her strength through getting out and walking, even if at first it was only to the end of the road. I just knew that this was important because it's too easy to become stuck, forever bedbound with this illness. We are the best of friends and going through this brought us closer. So there are always good things that come out of any situation. Sue's top tips for anyone supporting a recoverer are: just remember to not let it take over your lives, although that is easier said than done. But just being aware of it is a great place to start. As they're getting used to what they can do, testing their boundaries and what makes them tired, they will get used to it and know what they can and can't do. Encourage getting outside and walking. Build this up a bit at a time and don't take no for an answer. Learning to instill trust in what they can do is important. A gentle reminder every now and then is okay, just not every day. Changing those language patterns is key. Stop talking about illness, and of course, laughter is the best medicine, so a good movie and a hug go a very long way. As you know, there are many relationships that are affected when a condition like this comes into your life, and it's clear from Sue's very honest account that the dynamics within a family can be both a help and a hindrance to the person suffering. It's also very important for the needs of the supporters and the wider family to be recognised, having to live with this every day too. Killing with kindness. What Sue has spoken of here is that, like many supporters, she gave up her job, she suffered from worry and guilt, and invested every moment into her daughter's recovery. This is what most people would do. If they look at the phases of recovery, this is phase three, whereby a recoverer becomes defined by their illness. It's what everyone focuses on, and it dictates the way life is lived in a household. Other families have explained how the whole family got involved in fundraising, which, although it's very commendable, means that even more time is dedicated to talking about and living the illness. Other children in the family get sidelined, and that causes a lot of resentment down the line. It's really important to keep normal activities going in carers' lives and the other members of the family. At the time, Sue had no guidance to see that it's vital to use distraction when the conversation is dominated by illness. She had to learn the hard way how important it is to believe in recovery rather than be consumed by worry that the person won't get better. This is from the National Centre for Eating Disorders, which helps those who are caring for someone with an eating disorder. However, the advice is honest and valuable. Love alone will not help. The person with an eating disorder will almost certainly need professional help and treatment. Anyone who is not trained in eating disorder treatment will probably not be able to help a sufferer and may unwittingly make things worse by saying or doing the wrong things. Families, friends and colleagues can be valuable allies in an overall treatment plan. In fact, research shows clearly that recovery is faster and better when carers are taught how to be involved in the right way. The NCED go on to say, there is very strong evidence that helping carers makes it more likely that a sufferer will get help, accept help and recover. Working with carers helps us to help you do the right thing at the right time with someone who is struggling. We can even help you find a way through what may feel like a medical maze. Notice how honest and empowering this is. It really does say up front that you need to know how to help in the right way. The reason we cite this is because it is our firm belief that with informed support, the journey to recovery can be cut short. Without this information, it's very common for unhealthy dynamics to evolve, which is detrimental to recovery. So what might these look like? Unspoken payoffs. This is a difficult one, the world of unspoken payoffs. The dynamics that operate in families are complex at the best of times. When illness enters the equation, it can complicate things further. We want to look at the word control here. In relationships where there may have been some kind of strain prior to illness, whether that be between a parent and a child, a husband and a wife, or between partners, it can be a major factor on how the recovery process plays out. Let's take three scenarios we hear about over and over again. The resentful carer. A resentful partner that has the caring thrust upon them once this illness sets in. The relationship was far from happy prior to this, but the guilt factor means they stay and provide support. This may manifest in them being there physically, but the emotional support being missing. They may be unkind and say hurtful things, blaming the sufferer for the fact that they are stuck caring for them. In some cases, the person who is ill has attention from the carer who may have been absent or distant. This attention is a kind of emotional blackmail which, even though it's negative, may seem better than losing them altogether. The symptoms actually guarantee that the person stays. Ironically, the condition is probably the result of being in such a destructive relationship in the first place. The codependent carer. The issues of codependency come up too. This is something people can slip into without realizing, just like Sue explained. We all have needs, and if we need to be needed, having an ill person in our life can fulfill that need. So it can also stand in the way of wanting the person to recover. This is demonstrated when the carer does every little thing for the person they're caring for. When we bring up children, we are nurturing them, yet fostering independence. This is healthy. It's the same with someone who is ill. Self-esteem and confidence need to be rebuilt by encouraging them to do things for themselves wherever possible. Self-esteem and confidence need to be rebuilt by encouraging them to do things for themselves whenever possible. The carer gets a sense of significance by being the carer and disempowers the person in recovery. The controller can be either the person who is ill or the carer. Illness provides a space to fulfill their need or to control the other person. If the sufferer is that person who has been powerless in the past and craves control, then illness will be the vehicle that will give them control. It dominates what the carer can and can't do, the level of noise in the house, when and where they can go, and worst, even controlling when they're allowed to speak. This effectively makes a carer subservient to the person and their needs. In this situation, you may remember Lucy London in her interview talking about the unconscious nature of this type of dynamic. If the carer is controlling, they will run the show, dictating what the ill person can and can't do, making the decisions about what will and won't work in terms of intervention. We have had many occasions when carers read our material and make the decision whether or not to show it or consult the person that they are caring for. This reading and filtering of information and speaking for the person are controlling and disempowering acts, Elaine explains. This kind of power play goes on every day when one party is ill. I recently interviewed a Reiki practitioner who told me that she had an aggressive husband of one of her clients knocking down her door. He told her to cancel any further appointments with his wife because if she were to recover, he would lose his care allowance and his disability car. This is not an isolated case. One of our nutritionists had a client call her very early while her husband was in the shower. The client said if he wasn't allowed into the consultation, he could not allow her to attend. He was hitting his wife and knew that she would tell the nutritionist if he were not there. These are all unhealthy support dynamics. Fear can be a driver of unhelpful dynamics and is often present when children are faced with the uncertainty of illness in the home. Children can feel totally powerless when a parent is ill. Sometimes they become protective and take on too much responsibility for a young person. And in other cases, their way of dealing with it is to almost ignore the fact that it's happening. They will avoid the parent who is ill and look as if they really don't care. This can make a recoverer feel really hurt. It's often that they are experiencing a real fear of what this means for them. The only way they can deal with it is through denial that it's happening. If it is a sibling, then another child can feel that they are unimportant and that the parents only care about the sister or brother that's ill. When children lack attention, they will often act up to get some. They simply crave a little one-on-one attention but feel unable to ask for it. It's important to recognise that a child being awkward or uncooperative is a sign that they are feeling unloved or unimportant. Lane's husband Rob shares from his experience as a husband. I look back on the days when Elaine was really suffering as a dark time. I call it that because we really were in the dark as to why Elaine, who was always so full of life and energy, was suddenly unable to get up, let alone work or function as she once did. It's shocking to see someone you love in that state, and very upsetting when they burst into tears and ask questions that you can't answer. Why me? Will I get better? What happens if I don't? If I can't be me, who am I? Will people still like me if I can't do what I used to do? This feeling of helplessness was magnified by the total ambivalence of our GP, whose answer was to reach for the prescription pad to prescribe antidepressants. I remember a fierce argument with a house officer when Elaine went to hospital to see a neurologist. He still wanted to treat depression and would not accept that this was an effect of the illness, not the cause. I was lifted by the consultant neurologist who said, "These people get better." It is natural to try and research into what is happening. The first book I read was so grim, talking about wheelchairs and disability, that I resolved never to read another. Support groups were no better as they were concentrating on managing symptoms and claiming benefits. The words of the consultant stayed with me. These people get better. I just wish that message was available more centrally because I believe it kept me going. It is hard to leave the person you love most in bed, go to work and come back after a 12-hour day to find them still there. Then face the other chores of daily life to keep the household on track. Cleaning, cooking, washing, etc. But you have to hang on to the fact that it's for a finite time. And even though it feels like forever, it will pass with the right interventions. Rob's top tips. Always believe recovery is going to happen. Don't show fear to the person you are caring for, even if you feel it. Try and keep things normal. Still show an interest in what the children or other members of family are doing. Going to work and having to focus on something else kept me healthy and able to cope at home. Do what you need to do for yourself and keep working or keep hobbies alive. Look at what needs to change and make those changes. We sold our house and downsized so Elaine could rest and not worry about having to work while she was recovering. I used to read storybooks to Elaine when she couldn't sleep. Reassure. Recoverers are so anxious and need to hear that all will be well. Healthy dynamics. Healthy dynamics are when a recoverer is given the appropriate amount of support by a person or people who do not allow their lives to be consumed by the illness. The carer encourages independence and fosters a positive mindset that this will pass and the recoverer will indeed recover. The recoverer understands that the person providing support still needs to have a life. Try to create a calm and stress-free environment as much as possible. One where recoverers give permission to the supporter so that they may point out unhelpful behaviours like obsessively talking about the illness or expecting the supporter to do things that the recoverer can do for themselves. Siblings are given consideration so that they don't miss out on everything, even though they are not ill, to encourage each other to have hobbies and social activities so that the world does not become all about illness. To recognise and talk about the sexual and emotional needs of each other if you're in a relationship. To plan for health and well-being and call each other out when talk gets negative. Your top tips this week are great ones to include for your self-care to promote recovery. Be kind to yourself and do whatever it takes to release stress from your mind. Reiki or healing treatments are magnificent for calming the anxiety loop that is the curse of these conditions. If you're struggling with meditation, have a Reiki treatment. Check in with yourself. How much stretching are you doing each day? If you are really incapacitated, imagine your muscles stretching, then gradually start flexing and stretching each muscle. Review the videos from session 17 to help you, and use the yoga hub at least twice a week to build gentle movement into your recovery. And top tips on feeding your spirit this week. How about drawing or making something that allows you to get lost in your own world? Could you find out about an art class or a craft catalogue and see what you could do to tap into your creativity this week? We have our creative hub so you can get inspired from Becky, our artist in residence. And finally, how about creating a vision of your life beyond recovery? What are you going to do when you are well? Let your mind focus on your ideas and take yourself into those scenarios. Elaine says, in my visions, I wanted to write a book, work with monkeys, or help out in a wool shop. I didn't do two of them, but I did write a book. Beginning to investigate your possibilities is important. This week's well-being exercises include some questions that will help you to see if there are any changes either you or your supporter might benefit from making. To ensure that a healthy dynamic is in place, so that recovery is smoother and faster journey. Don't forget to email us with your breakthroughs or challenges, or pop into the Facebook page. Have a healthful week, and I'll be back with you the next session.